Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Most national public health authorities now recommend having at least two meals of fish every week. At the same time, the news is full of stories that would make you think twice about having fish, stories about various kinds of chemicals and other contaminants in the fish, and also stories about what is the effect of large-scale catching a fish on the global environment. And it brings you to the question, is it possible to still feel good about eating seafood? In this hour of Focus 580, that's the question we'll take up with Canadian writer Taras Gresko. He went around the world in search of both a delicious and humane plate of seafood. And he says, yes, it is in fact possible to have both, but you have to ask some questions and you have to make wise choices. All of this you can find in his recent book, Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. It's just out recently and has gotten a lot of positive attention. I think it's a very interesting book, full of a lot of interesting information, the kind of thing that would appeal to you, whether your concerns have to do with the environment and the relationship between how we live and the environment, or whether you're interested in cooking and food and where food comes from. All of that you can find in the book. Bloomsbury is the publisher, and I'm sure that you can find it down at the bookstore or at the library. Our guest is also the author of the previous book, The Devil's Picnic. His work appears in major publications all over the U.S. and the U.K. and Canada, including The Independent, Condé Nast Traveler, Gourmet, The Guardian, National Geographic Traveler, and The New York Times. He makes his home in Montreal, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. And if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or you might be listening across the country on the internet, you can use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Mr. Gresko, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Just to start out, for the record, as they say, so people can understand where you're coming from, you yourself like eating fish and would like to continue to eat fish, and it certainly is not your intention with this book to persuade people not to eat fish.
No, definitely not. I'm a piscivore, a seafood eater. I get most of my protein from seafood, and I started eating seafood about 14 years ago, exclusively. I mean, I of course eat vegetables and stuff like that, but I kind of shy away from poultry and red meat. And it's a decision that I sort of started to question as things like the cod collapse off the coast of Newfoundland began to happen. We started to hear that there were problems with catching tuna and dolphins at the same time, and the boycotts of Chilean sea bass and swordfish and a lot of fine restaurants. So I realized that my decision to eat seafood had ethical implications, and I set out to sort of set up an itinerary that would take me around the world and explore what was happening to the seafood out there.
Yeah. You, in the book, you reference something that I think this was a new idea to me, that not only is it the case that there are health benefits to eating seafood, and that seems to be documented, and that's the kind of thing that we're told, but apparently there's some thought that the consumption of seafood might actually have played a role in human evolution, that is, in developing the human intelligence and making us the creatures that we are now.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, there is a theory out there that competes with the savanna theory of evolution that says we evolved on the African savanna hunting, and that our bipedal gait came from the fact that we were sort of peering over shrubs in order to track down antelopes, that kind of thing. There's another idea out there, and more anthropologists are getting behind it, that we evolved on the seashore where there was a good supply of marine protein. And one of the strong pieces of evidence that supports this, and this spurt in evolution that might have happened about 2 million years ago when the human brain really started to expand, comes from the notion that there's a lot of DHA in seafood, which is one of the omega-3 fatty acids, and it's one of the only ones that allows for rapid brain development, which is also why we put it in formula now, for in infant formula, in order to help babies' brains develop. So there is an idea that we actually need some of the essential fatty acids in seafood in order to develop, and that without them, we wouldn't be human. So that's a sort of a strong argument for keeping seafood in our diet. Of course, the problem is, these days, there are a lot of contaminants in seafood, whether it's mercury or persistent organic pollutants like dioxins. And so you have to learn to navigate the seafood that's out there fairly carefully. And one of the things we can all do is eat a little lower down the food chain. Hence the title of the book, Bottom Feeder.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, a central idea that people can take away with them if their question is, okay, having listened to you and having thought about this, what do you do? Your suggestions are to avoid the big fish, the big carnivorous fish that are now certainly endangered because there's been so much pressure on them. These are fish like tuna and shark. Perhaps also the famous Patagonian toothfish that got renamed the Chilean sea bass. Avoid those kinds of fish and look for these things that are, as you say, lower down on the food chain. So you're talking about things like maybe herring and sardines and squid also?
Sure, yeah. Mackerel, all of the sort of the smaller schooling fish. We've had a tendency to, it makes sense. We've gone after the big fish at the top of the food chain, hence the cod, which can be relatively big, and halibut, which can weigh up to 700 pounds. They're almost completely fished out in the Atlantic now. We also like things like grouper. The shark, although it's not consumed a lot in North America, 90% of shark have been fished out in the oceans, mostly for the Asian shark fin soup trade. And I visit a restaurant in Shanghai that's devoted to the shark fin trade. So, yeah, we tend to like these big steak-like fish. Now, telling people that they should be eating the smaller fish can be a hard sell, particularly in North America. A lot of people say, oh, those are the fishy fish. I don't like the flavors. But what I discovered in traveling around the world is there are all kinds of culinary traditions, local culinary traditions, whether it's the Portuguese sardine barbecue or the fish soups that you get around the Mediterranean for cooking up these smaller guys, and it's actually quite delicious. One of the ones that I like is haddock as an alternative to cod and fish and chips.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad choice, especially if it's hook and line caught. Another thing that's happening is that aquaculture is emerging. There's a lot more fish farming than there used to be. In fact, you stand about a 1 in 2 chance of the fish in your plate coming from a farm these days. And back in 1980, there was, I think it was only 8% of all fish came from fish farms. So seafood is changing.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Taras Gresko. His book is Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. That's the subtitle. It's published by Bloomsbury. And it takes a look at the increasing pressure on wild stocks of seafood, the result of people demanding it more and eating it more, and concerns about the impact on the environment of all this consumption of seafood. And also there is, I'm sure we'll talk about concerns about farming, aquaculture, fish farming as well. It's an interesting book, so you should take a look at it. And of course, questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, as you point out in the book, there are some people around the world who have always been big fish eaters, the Japanese and people around the Mediterranean and probably lots of other people who live near the oceans, but that in recent years, I think that overall there's been an increase in consumption of seafood. And again, in part, it goes back to this kind of information that we've been given about it being good for us to have more fish. So people say, people in the middle of the United States who are a long way from the coast, who maybe in past generations just didn't eat that much fish, or maybe if they did, that was something that came out of, they ate canned tuna or canned salmon and maybe not that often at that. How has fish consumption around the world increased?
Well, it's a $71 billion a year industry now. And in the United States, it's increased by, total seafood consumption has increased by about 70% in the last generation. So that puts a lot of pressure on the fish in the sea. The reason that you can get good fish in the center of the United States, and we can get it all over the world now, is the improvement in shipping technologies. The Norwegians developed these things called styrofoam coffins back in the 1970s, and as far back as I think these are shipping containers that allow fish to be shipped fresh around the world, which as far back as 1971, Japan Airlines was actually shipping bluefin tuna from the coast of Nova Scotia in Canada all the way to Tsukiji Market in Tokyo. So this technology has been around for a while, and it allows us all to, if we're willing to pay the price, get fresh fish. It also means that we're going farther and farther out in the oceans to get the last of the remaining wild protein. You alluded to the Patagonian toothfish, also known as Chilean sea bass. When that first appeared on menus in the late 70s, it was being fished off the coast of Chile. Now they're chasing it to these last refuges in the seas of the Antarctic. So we have the technology now to actually chase fish populations to the ends of the earth and exhaust the populations, because perversely, as the fish become more and more scarce in some cultures, in Japan, for example, people are willing to pay higher and higher prices for them. So you get the situation where people are paying $1,000 for a single Chilean sea bass. Or I went to, I described going to Tsukiji Market in Tokyo and seeing tuna going for $20,000 a fish. And some tuna, the bluefin tuna, have sold for $175,000. Per fish, that's, for it's 700 to 800 pound fish.
And this is the kind of fish that's particularly prized for sushi.
Yeah, for toro in particular. You'll see it in restaurants. It's the fatty belly of the bluefin tuna, and it commands crazy prices. The Japanese are trying to do something about it. They're aware that stocks are disappearing, so they're actually starting to raise the bluefin in the lab from the larval stage, which might help the problem. Although, unfortunately, with a lot of forms of farming, fish farming, we have to grind up smaller fish in order to feed the big fish. This is true of salmon farming, shrimp farming, eel farming, and as I mentioned, it's the new trend for bluefin tuna farming. So you're actually taking, they actually have to catch smaller fish, perfectly edible fish like sardines and anchovies, and grind them up and make them into the pellets that feed the fish. So it's actually quite a wasteful industry.
Yeah. It's one of the things that to me I think is interesting about the book is how it folds in some culinary history, and it shows how interest in eating fish and sometimes interest in particular kinds of fish that has been touched off by well-known cooks,
sure,
can create a real problem. And the story, one of the kinds of fish that now there's a tremendous pressure on is the one that you mentioned, the Chilean sea bass, and that happened because a restaurant in New York decided to feature it, and suddenly it was the thing to have. And it happened before with the redfish because of the popularity of Cajun cuisine, and Paul Prudhomme made a big thing of blackened redfish. And then also going back, one of the big stories, and you write about in the book, is the monkfish and Julia Child doing this thing, showing people on television monkfish and talking about it, and suddenly now everybody wanted to have monkfish.
Yeah, it's a fairly memorable sequence. She wrestled with a 25-pound monkfish on her show, Julia Child and Company, back in 1979, I think it was. And in her inimitable voice, she showed us how to decapitate this thing. If you've never seen a monkfish, it's also called a lawyerfish, presumably an allusion to its really big mouth and sharp teeth. Not all lawyers have sharp teeth, of course. It's a scary fish, and she somehow managed to popularize it, and it became a competitor with lobster for a long time. In any case, I mean, it used to be thrown away as a trash fish, and these days it goes for $25, $30 a plate in the fine restaurants of New York. So definitely when the finger of culinary fashion descends on a fish, that can be very bad news for the fish. As you mentioned, the redfish, it happened with that. The trend for bluefin tuna has been disastrous for bluefin tuna. Some cases, the demand is so great that a farming industry develops. And that's happening with sablefish, for example, or black cod, which is caught off the west coast of North America, but they're now actually farming that fish. And farming has its own challenges and problems. Some kinds of farm fish are actually quite sustainable, things like tilapia and carp, even trout, which is raised inland in Idaho. Doesn't contaminate wild fish populations because it's raised sort of far from the seashore. But I mentioned farm salmon and farm shrimp in particular. They're quite problematic when it comes to having an impact on the wild fisheries.
Well, let's talk about fish farming and talk about salmon, for example, because
sure.
This is something that now it has made salmon very affordable for a lot of people, and it's a product that now I think people can get salmon. You can get fillets and steaks. This, again, for the people who maybe for a long time they or maybe it would have been parents or grandparents, the only salmon they would have recognized would have come in a can.
Yeah.
And now because of farming, particularly in the northeast of the United States and in Atlantic Canada, it's become a big industry. And now we have salmon. It's easily available. It's relatively cheap. At least it's cheaper than wild caught salmon. So it's possible to have it on the table, and I'm sure a lot of people now buy this product. They make it at home, and it's increasingly available in restaurants. And it is raised in net pens that are out in open water. And I think that environmentalists have been for some time now been really concerned about just what kind of impact these large groups of salmon that are raised in these pens, where there's no, essentially there's a net so they can't get out, but there's no boundary. The water goes in and out,
yeah,
and
exactly.
So anything that's happening with them is easy for it to swim through the holes in the net.
I'll tell you what's happening with the net pens in particular.
Yeah.
They're being raised off the coast of Chile and British Columbia. Alaska has wisely banned these net pens and salmon farms. So they're basically just floating nets, sort of hung around this framework of metal walkways. And they're a few hundred yards from the coast in general. And you can have up to 1.5 million salmon in every one of these farms. So an intense concentration of Atlantic salmon in the Pacific Ocean. They're naturally occurring parasites called sea lice, particularly in British Columbia, and they're attracted by all of this sort of free salmon flesh, and they feed on the farm salmon. In order to get rid of the sea lice, they treat them with a pretty heavy duty chemical, the same chemical that's used to treat pine beetles on land. But the big problem is that a lot of migrating wild salmon come down the rivers. And and the mouth of the rivers is exactly where they've sited a lot of these salmon farms. So basically, this farm salmon industry is passing sea lice on to the wild fish, and they're predicting that some of the populations in British Columbia could disappear completely in 3 or 4 years because of the presence of sea lice. So that's a problem. People are being told to eat salmon because it's a heart-healthy food. I know a lot of people have switched to salmon from beef and chicken and enjoy it. The problem is they're almost certainly eating farm salmon. 90% of the salmon sold in North America is farmed. There are all these problems with it. They're treated with antibiotics because they tend to come down with diseases. And frankly, personally, I just don't find them as tasty. I mean, I grew up eating wild salmon in Canada. And there's no comparison. I mean, the wild salmon is very firm-fleshed, whereas the farm product tends to be kind of mushy, to say the least. So it's an inferior product, and one I don't think we should that's a reasonable substitute for other fish. A good alternative to farmed salmon, I find, for example, if you like bagels, you can have smoked trout on as a substitute for lox on a bagel, that kind of thing. There's lots of alternatives. Salmon is just something that we think that has come to be seen as a cheaply available protein But the way it's raised now, it's not that good for us, and it's definitely not good for the oceans.
And just, again, to touch on something you mentioned before, for people who are concerned about the problem of overfishing, there is a relationship between that and this kind of aquaculture, because, as you say, what we're doing is the salmon what we're raising, we're feeding other fish to them. Well, that means we've got to go out and catch those fish in large numbers so that we can grind them up and process them and make them into the pellets we feed to the salmon.
4 pounds of 4 pounds of wild-caught fish to make 1 pound of salmon. I had the misfortune of eating one of those salmon farm pellets. I'm an experiential journalist, so I was willing to try anything. And believe me, I ate a lot of things in this trip. I ate everything from sea cucumber to monkfish, which was pretty enjoyable, but lots of different things. And the worst thing that I ate was those pellets in the salmon farm. They're made, and thank God I didn't swallow. They're made with, they kind of smell like if you left a tin of anchovies out on the counter for a day or two. They've got that rotten fish oil smell. Another thing that they're doing is they're catching krill, and this could be an ecological disaster, in order to coat the pellets with. The krill are these little shrimp-like creatures that form the basis of the food chain in the ocean. And these giant ships in the Southern Ocean around the Antarctic that suck up the krill. And krill feeds everything from humpback whales to penguins. It's a fairly basic form of protein in the oceans. And to be using it to make this luxury food that's only enjoyed in North America and Europe, really, is a bit of a crime against humanity in a world that's increasingly hungry.
Well, for me, I certainly enjoy having a salmon and have been, I guess, increasingly, and not frequently, but increasingly going to the store and looking for wild-caught salmon.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Is that okay?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I try to find wild Alaska salmon if I can. Last year in particular, the runs of Alaska salmon were in fantastic shape. They were doing quite well, and that's partly because they don't have any salmon farms up there to pass on parasites. But this year they're having a little more trouble, and that's reflected in the price. The salmon aren't returning in as high numbers. So you're getting Copper River salmon from Alaska costing $40 a pound by the time it gets to the middle of the United States and the East. So that's $2.50 an ounce, if you can imagine, for salmon. So unfortunately this year I'm sort of it's a predicament. I really love good wild salmon, but it's just too expensive these days. So I'm hoping next year's runs will be in slightly better shape.
We talked a little bit about the kind of aquaculture that they do in the open ocean, where they use net pens, and this is generally the way that a lot of the salmon that's now available is raised. You can also do it in tanks on the land, and that's the way that people raise trout and tilapia. What's your feeling about that kind of aquaculture?
I think that's the solution. There are so many water pollution problems around the world right now. In particular, a lot of our farm seafood comes from China, and these tilapia and carp and catfish that come from China are being raised cheek by jowl with pig farms. And of course, there's problems of cross-contamination. Raising them in concrete containment tanks, while it's more expensive, actually affords an incredible degree of control for the fish farmer. I met a sturgeon farmer in British Columbia who was raising sturgeon eventually for the caviar market, and there are these immense 7 or 8 foot long fish swimming around. They looked like prehistoric monsters, and he had nothing but praise for the system. You recycle the water, you reoxygenate it, you take out the waste, so it actually ends up, once you made the initial investment, it ends up being quite economical. And there's no reason salmon can't be raised this way. The only reason it's being raised off the coast, the west coast of the Americas this way, is that it's cheaper, and the Norwegians, who dominate the salmon farming industry, realize it'd be a lot cheaper to do this on the relatively sparsely populated coasts of British Columbia and Chile.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Taras Gresko. He's a Canadian journalist. His work has appeared in a number of places in the UK and the US and Canada, The Independent, Condé Nast Traveler, Gourmet, The Guardian, National Geographic Traveler, The New York Times. His book is Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. Bloomsbury is the publisher. It's out now. And questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We have one and we'll get right to. Let me give you the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here is a caller to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. One of my wife and I have a favorite fish that she cooks now and then. It's orange roughy. Can you tell me where it's from? And we've noticed the price is going up on these things, and we're beginning to wonder whether it's being overfished.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up orange roughy. That's a rough one. And a footnote there. You say the price is going up. That's when a price is going up on a wild caught fish. That's a sure sign that it's being fished out. That the stocks are disappearing. Orange roughy is kind of troubling that it's available where you're living. It's a fish that's caught on seamounts. Seamounts are these sort of undersea mountains that come up close to the surface of the ocean, and on particularly on the high seas, they're one of the few sources, oases of life. The orange roughy live around these seamounts, and a number of countries are fishing for orange roughy, New Zealand in particular. They send out these high seas bottom trawlers, and their nets can go down about a mile and a half. The nets have these heavy rollers that roll over the peaks of the seamounts and basically indiscriminately scoop up everything that's living on them, including deep-sea corals, that kind of thing, fragile formations that have taken centuries, if not millennia, to form. And it's all in pursuit of this one fish, the orange roughy. The orange roughy, what's more, is a long-lived fish. It can live to be 104 years old. We know this because of these otoliths, these little bones in the roughy's ears, which add layers of calcium every year of its life. It doesn't start reproducing until it's 40 years old. So when you take out the orange roughy for dinner, basically, I mean, you're removing a fish that's not going to reappear very easily. It's not like the sardines, which reproduce very, very quickly. So, you know, if there's one fish to avoid, I hate to say it because so many people appreciate it, but it's the orange roughy. And, you know, actually, it's going to be gone pretty soon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm amazed that that's widely available in your parts. I mean, I saw it in some menus and New York and found that pretty disturbing, but gosh, yeah, if you can stay away from it, do. I'd suggest go for a sable fish. Have you ever tried that? Or a black cod?
No.
That's a great fish. It's really got a buttery flesh, and it's hard to overcook. The fishery for that's fairly sustainable. It's off the Pacific coast of the United States. That's a good fish.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
right, thank you. Let's go on to another call. This is also someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Well, I'm not a picivore. I never have like seafood or any kind of fish. But I know it's supposed to be good for you, so I take fish oil capsules, and I was wondering what the ethics were of that. Where do they come up with that omega-3? Where do they come up with the fish oil?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'm going to take it offline.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. I've been looking into that lately. I discussed it a little bit in the book. I take omega-3 fatty acids. I think they're really good for the continued functioning of your brain. Apparently, omega-3s change the structure of your cell membranes. So they're more receptive to neurotransmitters, you know. They actually improve brain function considerably. As our mothers and grandmothers said, fish is brain food, and it turns out to be true. Another thing is that it can prevent diseases like Alzheimer's and possibly Parkinson's. There's a whole bunch of evidence coming in that's really good for the heart. So I take them, but the problem is, where do they come from? One source is a company called Martek, and they get theirs from plankton, which is actually a pretty good source. Another company based in Canada, which puts its supplements in infant formula, that kind of thing, gets it from sardines, anchovies, the so-called forage fish. Now, apparently, they only use about 1% of all of the fish oil in the world. So, as it stands right now, I don't think it's too much of a problem. If you look at salmon farming alone uses 3/4 of the fish oil in the world. So, you know, by taking the fish oil capsules, rather than getting your omega-3s from farm salmon, you're actually doing the world a bit of a favor. So, continue taking them. I think they're really good for your health, and they're not really too much of a problem for the long-term sustainability of the oceans.
All right, let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Munster, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes?
I was calling because I happen to like Escalar. It also goes by the name of Walu, that fish. And I know it's gotten a lot of bad press.
Yeah.
And I'm not seeing it much anymore. Have they just discontinued, you know, serving that kind of fish? And is there any truth to the rumors about it? I mean, I've heard people have died after eating it, but I've never had a problem at all. And I'll listen offline.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, Escalar. That's an interesting fish. It's also called white tuna. It's an interesting fish because you can't eat. I've never heard of anybody dying from it. It's caught in the Pacific in particular. It's kind of a warm water reef fish, and chefs love it because it has a really high oil content, and it's got a particular kind of oil, the same kind of oil that they use in olestra, the famous fat that passes right through the body. It was used in chips for a while. So chefs were only serving, you know, if you serve more than 6 ounces of the stuff at a time, customers were likely to come back with complaints because of the indigestibility of the fats in the escalar. It might have been pulled from menus for that reason. It was popular for a while. And then it just, you're right, it's kind of just disappeared. It was the it fish in Manhattan for a little while. So I think sometimes, you know, fish become popular for a little while, and because there are problems associated with them, problems of supply, or in this case, problems of the fats in the escalar, they're pulled. I mean, I don't think escalar has been overfished yet, but it's one you have to be careful with for sure.
Again, our guest is our Focus 580, Taras Gresko. His book is Bottom Feeder, the subtitle, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. So you can go out and look for the book. And the questions, again, are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Quite a significant amount of the seafood product that's consumed here in the United States is farmed, and a lot of it is coming from Asia. And there are concerns about potential contaminants, either things that somehow may be introduced intentionally or either accidentally. What for particularly for imported farmed seafood that we might eat, or I'm maybe in Canada as well, what is the concern there, and how do consumers try to get a handle on what it is they're eating and where it's come from and whether or not it's safe?
Yeah, good question. So much of the seafood that's imported from Asia now is treated with antibiotics. They have to be treated with antibiotics because they're often crowded together in ponds, and they come down with diseases. So they load them up with these commonly available antibiotics, like chloramphenicol is one, nitrofurans. They're carcinogens. Chloramphenicol causes aplastic anemia. And unfortunately, our screening, both in Canada and the United States, is not very good. The FDA only screens about 1.59% of imported seafood. And so that's just a tiny amount. The states of Arkansas, for example, Louisiana, have their own screening programs, and they do that because they've got their own farmed seafood industries, particularly with catfish, and their analysis have shown that, you know, there are a lot of these contaminants in the imported stuff. So you have to be careful. I tell people to favor, if they can, domestically farmed seafood.
channel catfish is a great choice from the southern states. Some shrimp is being raised in the Americas, in Mexico. They're raising it inland. But yeah, we've got to demand better labeling from the authorities. There's just too little information available right now. There are country of origin labeling laws, but they'll often just tell you where the stuff was processed. So a cod could be caught in the Barents Sea in the north of Europe, shipped to China for processing, but because it's filleted in China, it just says product of China. The situation as it stands right now is quite confusing. We don't have enough information, and I think this is one area where we really have to ask for better labeling. And consumers can help, too. I mean, if you actually have a relationship with a fish market or a fishmonger, you can request things. You can get into the habit of asking which ocean a fish comes from, and whether it's farmed or wild-caught. Those are a couple of very basic questions to ask.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about what can happen with a particular fish if a well-known chef or cook decides to talk about it and popularize it. Also, though, I suppose that people who are in that kind of business, particularly people who run high-profile restaurants, in addition to being part of the problem, they could be part of the solution.
Definitely.
And they're, in fact, one of the things that we saw after concerns, people started to raise concerns about the Chilean sea bass, there was actually a movement among food people to discourage people going, restaurant chefs from putting it on their menus and discourage people from ordering it. So is there some room here for people in the either food writers or people who are in the food business to try to educate people and also give them the opportunity to make better choices?
Yeah, well, those consumer boycotts are interesting. They had a tendency to backfire because, you know, there was the boycott of swordfish, for example. Chefs had noticed that swordfish, which used to be 200 pounds, were coming into markets at 20 or 40 pounds, and they sort of voluntarily said, okay, we're going to stop serving this for a little while. We're going to give them a break. But unfortunately, there were sustainable swordfish fisheries out there, particularly in the Pacific. There are guys who caught them with harpoons rather than nets, which is a good way of fishing them. So a lot of fishermen objected to it, and quite rightly. So boycotting an entire species can be counterproductive for a chef. What I like is what chefs like Rick Moonen in Las Vegas are doing, Barton Seaver in Washington, D.C., who runs a restaurant called Hook. They're experimenting with serving things a little farther down the food chain. So rather than using the stick, you know, of banning a seafood, they're offering the carrot of interesting dishes made with smaller fish. The sardines I've been alluding to, mackerel, which is quite common. It's used for bait right now, but it's actually a fantastically flavorful fish, and it's one of the highest in omega-3s out there. And a lot of these guys are putting together menus, sometimes in conjunction with local aquariums, to popularize the idea of eating a little lower down in the food chain, which is great for our health, and for the health of the oceans.
Let's talk with some more callers here. Bloomington, Indiana is next on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I came in late into the program, but when I did tune in, you mentioned another source of omega-3 fatty acids, and I think you said Martek.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay, I'm familiar with the company. There was a researcher who at one time worked at Texas A&M, and I tried to contact her. She's now working at Martek in their Colorado plant. And the reason I wanted to contact her, but it was just sufficient for me to talk to the researcher at Texas A&M, is this lady said that catfish in the South is a real big deal, but no one has come up with a technique to give a supplemental feed to the fish that would allow their bodies to elongate and desaturate a particular lipid so they would manufacture a DHA. Do you know if anyone has done this at all with pond fish given a particular supplement?
Oh, gosh, yeah, it's a real problem.
Does my question make sense to you?
Oh, sorry?
Does my question make sense?
Oh, it makes complete sense. This is a big challenge, of course, getting aquaculture-raised fish, especially the freshwater fish, getting a finished product that's relatively high in omega-3 fatty acids. And one of the misconceptions is that farmed salmon, for example, is high in omega-3 fatty acids. Actually, they're putting more and more soy into their feed. The way that we get the omega-3 fatty acids is through the food chain, is ultimately from plankton. And MarTech is taking the omega-3 fatty acids from, or is producing the omega-3 fatty acids via plankton rather than through the intermediary of sardines and anchovies, which other companies are doing. To tell you the truth, I haven't heard very much about whether anybody's succeeded in boosting the omega-3 fatty acid levels of fish like catfish, which are a little lower in it than ocean fish. They have worked on it, but I haven't heard of anybody succeeding so far, I'm sorry to say. Ocean Nutrition is a big name in when they're based in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, is a big name in this industry, as is MarTech, which was originally founded by Lougheed Martin, I think. But you might have to follow up on their websites to find more information on whether they're pursuing that themselves. The feed industry, I know, is pretty unregulated right now, and I haven't heard of any really highly omega-3 fatty acid supplemented pond fish at this point.
Yeah. Well, the majority of the information I come across is in the peer-reviewed literature that the university purchases. And the soybean oil doesn't really impress me because that's an omega-6 and it simply will not elongate and desaturate, so you get a DHA component in the fat of the fish. But
and they're
my other point,
that to tilapia now and other farmed fish.
My other question is, MarTech has a byproduct. When they run their 2-phytoplankton through their fermenter, then their centrifuge, then they pull off their oil that they then sell to people. But they have this, I'm going to call it like a sawdust pulpy material, and it's has 6 double bonds, and basically it's a good supplement to give to any kind of chickens or poultry or anything else that you want to get the DHA component in. The problem is that because it's such a highly unsaturated lipid, it's prone to oxidation.
Oxidation, so you get that rancid smell, and yeah, it's not stable.
Right, and what they do is they give a very small amount, and I've read their patents. 20 parts per million ethoxyquin. Ethoxyquin is a synthetic antioxidant, and if this is a name that you're not familiar with, that's okay, but my real concern is, are you at all familiar with this particular metabolite and what it breaks down to?
Well, you know, I'm not a scientist, so I haven't encountered that, no.
Okay. Well, okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, pleasure.
Just to make sure I understand this, that the omega-3 fatty acids, the stuff that we want to have for the health benefits that are in the fish, they are a product of what it is the fish eat, and so that's the reason why it is more present in particular kinds of saltwater fish than it is in freshwater fish?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it ultimately comes from plankton, you know, from the little floating, the phytoplankton in the oceans, the floating plant material. So if you eat, and it concentrates up the food chain. So eating sardines and mackerel is actually a great source of omega-3s, whereas the freshwater fish, like trout, aren't such a great source. That's a sort of a good guiding line. And the northern seas or the colder seas are a lot richer in the plankton. So tropical fish like grouper or the escalar they refer to actually don't have as many omega-3s as the schooling northern cold water fish like mackerel and sardines and anchovies, those kinds of things.
All right, we have about 5 minutes left, and I have two other callers. We'll try to get them in, starting here first with Chicago, line one. Hello.
I remember Jacques Cousteau years ago, when he was still around, said he would not eat any fish unless he knew where the waters it came from. Then around that time, when he was still around, China made a statement that if they could have it, they would have all the fish in the ocean for themselves if they could get it. But it just shows you what kind of a population situation we're dealing with, too. On another side of the fish and so forth, we have the matter of calamari and octopus that people have a fondness for in parts of the world.
Yeah.
What are your views on them?
Sorry, what was the question?
He said, what are your views? What do you think about the?
Well,
think
there's
about
an
this?
Enormous amount of squid in the world right now. Actually, I'll just address the China thing. I went to Shanghai for one of the chapters in the book, and I was there during the Chinese New Year. And in the space of 1 week, they ate as much seafood as Ireland eats in an entire year, this one city, Shanghai. The Chinese are enormous consumers of seafood now. They're outbidding Japan on the seafood commodities markets, and they're sending their distant water fleets out to Africa and Bangladesh with these trawlers that bring back the fish. And it's actually a big problem because a lot of it's unregulated. Squid is an interesting question. Squid is they say there's more squid in the ocean than all the other fish combined. The biomass of them is just so huge, I have no problem with eating squid. The way they're fished is sometimes a problem. They use these big lamps to attract them, these lamps in particularly in the Pacific that are visible from outer space. And sometimes they use long lines, which catch other species. But in theory, squid, calamari, that kind of thing, are in fine shape. A lot of them are inedible because they're so full of ammonia. But the edible species aren't so bad. So in the case of some species, like jellyfish, and there's a tradition of eating jellyfish salad in Asia, it's actually not bad. It's a good cold appetizer. It doesn't have a very strong taste, and tastes mostly like soy sauce and sesame oil. It's kind of a nice texture. You're actually doing the oceans a favor by eating them. There are far too many jellyfish in the oceans right now, and that's mostly because the big species have been overfished, the shark and the tuna that I alluded to.
One more point. Have you ever tried whales?
Well, I regret to say that there's a chapter in my book about Japan where I went to a whale restaurant. They serve mink whale in Japan. Do you know mink whale?
Never heard of it.
Mink is a relatively abundant smaller species of whale. They say there's about 2 million of them living in the Southern Ocean. Whale kind of looks like it's a really deep red flesh. It looks like horse meat a little bit, and they've got so much of it in storage in Japan because nobody wants to eat it anymore. That a lot of it arrives frozen. They can't get rid of the stuff. General MacArthur encouraged people in Japan to eat whale meat after World War II because there weren't many other sources of protein. So it's a lot of older people in their 50s and 60s who have a memory of eating it in the post-war period. And they're the ones who keep these restaurants going. But it's a terrible industry. There's no real excuse for whaling anymore. We don't need the scientific information that it brings us, and I think we should just leave these magnificent animals be.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that the Japanese government should so fiercely defend their ability to take whales, which they say are for quote-unquote experimental purposes, but the meat still ends up on plates somewhere. But it's interesting that, as you say, younger people apparently in Japan, they have no interest in eating whale.
No, they've tried to sell it in fast food restaurants. They've tried to put it in school. Well, they put it in school boxes, you know, box lunches, just to get rid of the stuff. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of younger people in Japan are actually sort of fond of whales, and they've seen the movies, and they don't want to be eating them. So I hope it's a dying industry. It's a nationalist thing there. It's you know, it's protecting Japanese identity, which is why sometimes the actions of Greenpeace and the Sea Shepherd Society backfire, because there are these hardcore nationalists in Japan. Every time you say stop taking the whales, they just get more and more entrenched in their positions, and the industry continues.
Yeah. Real quick, we'll try to do one more caller here. Line 2, Champagne. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Like Inside Edition here. What about the brand Nordic Naturals? Comes from Norway.
Nordic Naturals?
Well, for the that's the brand name.
Huh.
It's for the oil, you know, the...
It's an omega-3.
Right. Are you familiar with that?
You know what? I'm not. I mean, I wonder, do you know anything more about them? Do they say, does it come from an ocean source? Does it come from plankton?
Well, all it says is it came from Norway, which could be a hedge. You know, that's all it says on it. But, that's all I got on it, from Norway.
Usually, I mean, when I buy omega-3 fatty acid supplements. I check to see, usually it'll say anchovies or sardines or from plankton, that kind of thing. You want the stuff that that's screened so there's no contaminants in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they might get it from codfish.
Mm-hmm.
That's one source.
Yeah. This is is it cod liver oil or codfish? I guess is maybe possibly.
Yeah, exactly. Because they have a huge cod fishery. I can't tell you. You know, I know the biggest company in North America for omega-3s is this Ocean Nutrition place, and they get it from the smaller fish, the forage fish, which is a pretty good source because there aren't many contaminants in it. You might want to do some research yourself. Nordic Naturals has a website.
And I'm looking at it right now, as a matter of fact, and what they say is that their fish oils come from sardines and anchovies.
Yeah, which is pretty common these days. And
great news.
And I think that's a fine source. It'll be lower in contaminants.
Usually in your natural food stores is where that's at.
Yeah, one thing to stay away from is seal oil. You find that in the health food stores, and that's actually cold pressed from seal bodies. And there's not many people know about it, but there's a big risk of a disease called brucellosis with this, which can cause all kinds of problems, including inflammation of the testicles. It's a nasty disease. So, I mean, you're better off getting your omega-3s from the smaller species, like from sardines and anchovies. So Nordic Natural sounds fine to me.
We're just about the point we have to finish, maybe in about 30, 40 seconds. Again, just to tell us the what you would recommend, the kind of fish that you think is okay.
Well, I mean, there's a whole list of them. As a general principle, sort of from in my day-to-day life, I'm going for the little guys. I go for like smoked herring or pickled herring or herring in cans. I go for mackerel. I eat a lot more oysters and lobster than I used to. Lobsters are in really good shape these days, oddly enough, because their main predator has disappeared. I'll go for things like sablefish, Arctic char, trout, barramundi, and I'll finish with a fish called pollock, which is actually fished in the Alaskan waters. Huge fishery and currently in very good shape. Mm. And that goes into filet-o-fish sandwiches, oddly enough. McDonald's doesn't acknowledge that they're using the sustainably fished stock, but they are.
You want to read more on the subject, look for the book Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood, published by Bloomsbury, by our guest, Taras Gresko. Thanks very much.
A real pleasure.